Happy holiday weekend. Happy Labor Day. Happy Labor Day to all the laborers out there. How does anyone have to work on Labor Day? That doesn't make any sense at all. Right? Not right.
But it happens.
The super essential people, which we're not one of. We will be out on Monday because there's a baseball game. I have guest in studio, Dr. Julie Strassman, my very good friend Melissa, both from Bethesda and specifically NODA, No One Dies Alone, which I joined about a year ago now. Can you believe it's been a year?
Yeah.
That's
incredible.
Nuts.
Yeah.
I don't know which way it is. It seems shorter, it seems longer, but it doesn't seem like a year. And just let me briefly tell you the story to catch all you guys up. My mom passed away July 26th of last year, Bethesda Dilworth. On her last couple of nights with us, they said, we have this organization called No One Dies Alone, where volunteers will sit vigil with your mom from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. so you guys can go home and get some rest. And I was insanely blown away. Like, I just couldn't believe that that was possible. And Melissa, I don't know if you know this, but I went and I bought a bunch of like honey buns and stuff and like left it in a box. And I just couldn't believe that people were going to do that.
Yeah.
And someone was with my mom when she passed away at like 3:30 in the morning, and he left this really detailed and beautiful account of her passing. And so I joined it and I took all the training and I've been doing it for about a year now. I think Melissa and I may be doing a vigil tomorrow evening with someone who's emergently passing at Dilworth. And it's been the coolest thing I've done, the most challenging, rewarding. It's amazing. And you guys can do it too. You can volunteer like so many have, and we'll tell you how to do that in a couple of minutes. But you have something cool coming up on September 13th. So, Doc, tell us about that.
Yes, we're so excited. So Bethesda Hospice has a really long history of doing unique and creative things to help people honor their loved ones, celebrate their lives, and also to process their grief. So Saturday, September 13th, we're doing our annual memorial, and we're doing something special this year. So in addition to doing a ceremony, we're actually going to be having some interactive stations. So what it will look like is when you come in, you'll get a ribbon. You write your loved one's name on that ribbon and pin the ribbon to your shirt. Then we'll have the memorial ceremony. We'll read all of those names aloud, so we'll honor everyone. And then after the ceremony, we open up different stations. And these stations are designed to help people really honor their loved one and process their grief in creative ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we have a journaling station where you can write about your loved one. We have a self-care station where you can make a lavender sachet and something to just bring you a little bit of comfort. We have even an origami station where you can make the world's simplest but beautiful little cardinal to honor your loved one. And then when you're all done, when you've visited as many or as few stations as you like, you can take off your ribbon and pin it on our memorial wreath. So at the end of the day, we have this beautiful fluttering wreath of ribbons.
Very cool. I know with my own experience, so I lost my dad and my brother in 2002 when I was 38. And I was 38 going on 18. And the way I processed that was so different than my mom when I was about to turn 60. And I expected, since I had been through it, I know how this goes, and I know how this feels, and I know how long it takes.
Boy.
And it has surprised me because it's not like that this time. And I think I told you, for me at least, and I'm going to guess for most people, the grief definitely comes in waves.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling good, getting stronger, haven't thought about texting my mom in a couple weeks, bam, and it just hits you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's never a straight line. Grief really does kind of go up and down. It comes in waves. And also, every grief is unique. Anytime you lose someone, your relationship with that person is unique. And so your grief for them is going to be unique as well.
Yeah. And it's also like we, you know, different cultures handle death in different ways. But here in America, and the way that I did it with my mom, there was such a buildup to it.
Mm.
You know, she's fallen, she's broken her hip. Let's go to the nursing home twice a day. Let's bring her flowers. Let's do this. Let's do that. I think she's going to pass in a few days. Let's be there as much as we can. Someone's going to sit with her. Hey, I just want to tell you, Dave, your mom passed away. There was so much to it. And then she was just gone.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Like when I come to do vigils now, I walk by room 305 and I'm like, that's where it happened.
Mm.
But now it's just someone else's room.
Mm.
It's just, it's not unceremonious or it's not cold. It's just life moves on.
Mm. Yes, and I think so many people do have that feeling of when you lose someone you really love, your world stops for a little while.
Yeah.
And it takes some time to kind of get back into that regular flow of life.
And you really clock the world around you not slowing down.
Exactly.
Because you're going at the same pace. Mm-hmm. And then when you stop and it doesn't, you're like, wow.
Right. It's a huge change. And everything feels different when you're grieving. And we tell people that things are going to feel different for a while. And that's okay.
Yeah. Was there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of our goal in hosting this event is for all ages. So not only, you know, us as adults processing our grief, we have things aimed at children processing their grief. You know, the grandparents that they lose, the aunts and uncles. That's a lot of grief that's unprocessed in many families. So we're giving the opportunity for stations that are also for children mm-hmm. and teens. Such as coloring stations, the nice. Journaling station, just to help them kind of process what they're going through and the loss that they're facing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely. Because the grief journey is different, not only for individuals, but also for different ages. Every developmental stage is going to handle grief differently.
Yeah. Kev, have you been through it yet? Losing someone close?
Not to the degree that we're talking about. Yeah. Like my grandmother, you know, that's probably the closest one, but it was also... She was really old, and I was pretty young, much younger than I am now. And they, you know, it was. It's not this. I don't think it's the same, at least in my experience.
Yeah.
Unless it's immediate.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because you kind of expect it, right? Like you expect your grandparents are always old to you. You know, mm-hmm. you're a little kid. They may not be. Like my grandmother was probably 40 when I was little, and I 45, and I thought she was old. And now I'm older than that, but not. That's really the closest that I've experienced so far.
I remember when Phoebe was about 5, probably kindergarten. And she went to Catholic school, and she came home one day, and we're taking a walk, and she said, I learned about Jesus today. I'm like, oh. I said, who do you think Jesus was? And she stopped, and she really thought, and she goes, he's this very nice man that pulls grandmas out of their dying holes.
Oh, that's great. How sweet is
and
that?
I was like, I can't argue with any of that. That's, that's pretty good. Put that in the New Testament.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely love that.
Yeah, if I could say though, Kevin, when it comes to the grieving process, I mean, even if you wanted to attend events such as this, it would be something that kind of leads you to have healthy ways to cope
gotcha.
When you do come to that time.
Because it's going
to
happen.
Yeah, eventually you'll face this moment and this will give you ways in advance to cope.
Yeah. Well, and this event I think is really designed for not only people who are grieving very deeply, but people who just want to honor their loved one and celebrate their life.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think at the El Monstero this year, I wasn't there, but the big outdoor concert, they have an in memoriam. And I think they put a picture of my mom up, which is like means the world.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's great.
It's just like, I don't know.
Well, and so many people tell me that one of the things that they miss the most after their loved one dies is just hearing their name.
Yeah.
Sometimes people stop saying their name.
Yeah.
And so just hearing their name read aloud as part of a ceremony can be so meaningful.
And it's really true. This is going to sound very schmaltzy and cliche, like put it on a Hallmark card, but I found it to be true that although your loved one is no longer alive on earth, they continue to live, not just in your memories, but like conversations and stories and even with that you have to, it's not always pleasant. Sometimes like we were on vacation a couple weeks ago and we started talking about mom and it was very funny, but afterwards I had a little bit of a sick feeling in my stomach, you know, just like, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Kind of brings it back up.
Well, I think you're exactly right though, that they do live on in so many ways, you know, whether it's spiritually, whether it's through the memories, but also I think the ways that they shape us as people, the values that they've taught us, the ways that they formed us into who we are today, all of that continues on.
Yeah. Melissa, you probably won't like this because Melissa is the person who has to train all of the NOTA volunteers.
Yeah.
So I'm like, hey, Mike Bush's podcast just came out. She's like, great.
Here comes the deluge.
But yeah, but let's talk to the people out there who, when they hear being a hospice volunteer and sitting vigil with people, what that means and what they can do if they want to become a part of it.
Yeah, so actually I just onboarded a brand new volunteer last night and sat vigil with her for the first time. So you definitely want to be prepared to sit vigil and then sit vigil solo. So what that looks like is you're sitting bedside with someone who's in the last 24 to 72 hours of their lives, and you're giving an honoring presence and you're giving a comforting presence to them. And to sign up for the program, it's a very simple step of just, you know, getting in contact with myself, and I start the onboarding process with you. A few trainings later, you are then sitting NOTA vigil with a seasoned volunteer who's going to show you the ropes. And when you're comfortable, keyword comfortable, when you're comfortable, you're able to sit solo vigil.
And it's really just a fantastic experience. So many of our volunteers tell us that it's one of the most meaningful things that they've ever done. And the families, of course, are so grateful that we're able to be there for them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, the last one I did with Melissa, a grown granddaughter came to see her grandma, and she was gone within 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, she was.
So many things.
You
never know, because you'll say, like, people wait till you're gone. People wait till you're there. But there seems, and maybe it's just complete happenstance and we're like just assigning meaning to it. But if you see enough of these, like.
That's exactly what happened with my grandmother.
Yeah.
I was the last person in the family to arrive.
Oh, wow.
And 10 minutes later.
She's like, I can't take this loud kid.
She's like, dang it, this guy.
Oh, that's great.
We really do see that, though. We see people wait for particular loved ones. We have even seen people wait for special dates.
Huh. Oh,
yes.
Wow.
I remember one woman who was sitting vigil with her mom, and her mom was really hanging on, and we weren't sure why. And eventually, I started asking her about, well, are there any particular special dates coming up? And she said, actually, yes, tomorrow is my parents' wedding anniversary. And her dad had already passed on. And so she kind of jokingly said to her mom, you know, Mom, if you want to be with Dad on your anniversary, you better get a
move
on.
Better get going.
And sure enough, she passed the next day on her wedding anniversary, which we thought was incredibly beautiful and meaningful.
So if people want to come to the grief seminar ceremony, how do they do it?
Absolutely. So they can sign up at BethesdaHealth.org. It'll be under the column News and Events. So we're asking for folks to pre-register so that we can have enough refreshments. But honestly, if you forget and you just want to come that day, it's absolutely open. It's free. It's open to all ages. Everyone is welcome. And so we hope people will come. It's located really conveniently as well. It's at 1333 West Lockwood Avenue. It's right off of 44. On the corner of Southbury Road and Lockwood Avenue.
Cool.
So very convenient.
And I'll be there that day. I want the lavender sachet booth, not the origami, because we'll have some really screwed up looking cardinals. So.
And the men who hold high places must be the ones who start.
Welcome back, DGS 221.
Reality.
Kind of an early out today. Close, we have an early Cardinals game. The pregame will start about 4:45. Game is at 5:40. Reds, right?
It is the Reds.
So, I don't want to feel dumb talking about, like, playoffs, but this is a really important series. If we have any chance at all. Let's just pretend it is.
If we're pretending, then yes.
Yes.
Because the Reds are the team immediately in front. Like, the Reds are the first team out of the wild card right now behind the Mets. But even the Reds, they're four games out.
Yeah.
So, you know, but we said this all along. We being, like, you know, me and Paulie and Bernie and all that. Like, once the Mets stopped falling on their faces, that race was going to pull away. And they have. But the Cardinals are not only behind the Reds, they're behind the Giants and the Diamondbacks. Well, they're tied with the Diamondbacks, too. So,
yeah.
6.5 games out at this point with that many teams.
You need to work on your pretending.
I'm just saying, I'm a sucky pretender, dude.
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. You know, is there a chance? Yes. The 2011 team was 9 games out at the end of August. But this team doesn't have Albert Pujols or Lance Berkman or prime age Yadier Molina or any of that. So, and then in that case too, it was only one team you had to chase down. It was Atlanta, and they fell apart.
Yeah.
So if only one team, it would be a different view, but it's four teams that you got to chase down.
Fast food news, Rach?
Yeah, we've got some big news coming out of Taco Bell. So they're bringing back the Decades menu. You'll remember this last fall. They brought back items for a limited time that represented different decades starting from the 60s. Well, now they're bringing us the Decades Y2K menu. And it's all from the 2000s.
All right.
So they're bringing back things like Cool Ranch Doritos Locos Tacos. I remember these.
This is too. Like your teenage years, right?
Yes. That came out when I was in college. I very specifically remember when the Doritos Locos Tacos came out.
Mm-hmm. Everyone remembers where they were.
The Double Decker Taco is coming back. They're saying this gained widespread popularity in 2006.
I liked the Double Decker Taco.
The 7-layer burrito. This is a vegetarian favorite. The chili cheese burrito, which you could still get at some Taco Bells in the area, but I like that it's coming back on this decades, Y2K decades menu, because that was my jam,
it sounds
chili
good.
Cheese burrito. And the caramel apple empanada. They're also releasing some drinks in conjunction with this. They don't have anything to do with the throwback, but something to keep in mind with Taco Bell.
Okay. What are the drinks, out of curiosity?
They are a new
lineup
of...
Now you're doing this segment just for him.
They're killing the drink game lately.
So they're called Refrescas, Andrew. Mm-hmm.
They've had those in Alton for a while at least. I've been enjoying them. They have a mango one that my wife really likes, and I like... It's like a Rockstar energy kind of fruit punch one. So it's got like... It's like an energy drink, basically. But it's good. I've been enjoying them.
They have the Stolz's stamp of approval.
There you go.
Refrescas. Mm. Okay, let's move on to Captain D's. I know Captain D's is one of Dave's favorites.
Here we go.
Hey.
They are launching some new batter-dipped shrimp. So it's dipped in a savory and slightly seasoned batter that's made in-house each day. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. You going to try that, Dave?
I'll give it a shot.
Nom some shrimps.
I'm a fish plank guy.
Like the planks?
Mm-hmm.
Planks are good. Sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah.
You just need a couple of planks of fish.
It's all you need.
Burger King is debuting a new crispy onion Whopper, which is a quarter-pound flame-grilled beef patty served with lettuce, tomato mayo, American cheese, bacon, pickles, breaded onion rings, fried onion crisps, and barbecue sauce on a toasted sesame bun. You can also order this as a Whopper Jr. And they're bringing back the Cinnamon Minis. These are bite-sized cinnamon rolls served with a sweet icing dipping sauce. You get four in an order.
So I order a good amount of Burger King. I feel like I can say this. The Whopper Jr. is a lie. It used to be my favorite sandwich. Now it's smaller than a regular burger. It has nothing in common with the Whopper at all. So just be warned.
Thank you for the warning. But, I mean, that's the kind of thing people actually do need to know about.
Yeah, just get a Whopper.
This isn't really fast food news. It's fast food adjacent, though, because our friends at Crushed Red have elevated a former Burger King location on Manchester Road. So 14124 Manchester Road used to be a Burger King. It has now been renovated into a Crushed Red, and they kept the drive-through. So, I mean, Crushed Red makes great food. This would just be a fun place to check out in general. Wanted to give them a little shout out there.
Big Crush Red fan.
One more story for you guys for fast food news. Smoothie King has introduced its first ever food menu alongside their smoothies. It's the Power Eats menu. It comes with things like peanut butter toast, chocolate hazelnut toast, avocado toast. I feel like I'm saying toast really weird. Eggs and cheese protein box, a peanut butter and fruit protein box. So these are all just like little snacky treats you can get with your smoothie and make it more of a well-rounded meal instead of just a little pick-me-up.
Nice.
I think this is cool. Wish we still had the Smoothie King in our building. But,
dude, speaking of, I don't know if you've seen this, but at least once a month, sometimes once a week, I see someone sitting at the drive-thru of Smoothie King, and there are literally wires sticking out of it. And, like, it's all boarded up, and they're, like, yelling at it.
I just want the gladiator.
Yeah, the menu is, like, vandalized and torn apart.
With almond milk and peanut butter. Let's go.
I do miss that.
Banana!
Welcome back, guys. DGS 1041 FM KMOX. Happy Friday to everybody. Happy Labor Day weekend. It sounds like it's going to be an absolutely gorgeous one. Bernie Miklas joins us. Hey, Bern.
Dave, good to be with you, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, my friend. Yesterday, the day before, I asked Matt Pauly and Wheels, what are you guys sick of talking about? And they had two answers. One was attendance, and the second was crappy pitching, and I'm going to make you talk about both. So I watched with great interest your TikTok the other day, Bern, about the low attendance and how from 77 to 81, which were my high school years, and I remember them very well, the Kenny Reitz and those guys era, that we had very low attendance, like, you know, middle of the pack, maybe even a little bit lower in the major leagues. And my question is, as a guy who's gone to over 30 games, games this year and who is not disgusted with my fellow fan. I'm not that guy at all, but it's just like weird and kind of gross being in a stadium with 9,000 people. What do you think it is this time around, if anything different at all?
Well, there is a common thread here, and that's why I did that thing, because I wanted to put some historical perspective into this, because I think although the attendance problem is a big issue for the Cardinals, and it's a surprising issue for the Cardinals because Busch Stadium's been packed for so long, there's a precedent for this. This isn't the first time it's ever happened. The Cardinals won the World Series in 64 and 67, and they won the pennant in 68. And then starting in 69, they had a downturn, and it lasted really up until the time Whitey Herzog came to town in 1980. And so, in the 69 and through the 70s, they didn't make the playoffs. And granted, it was tough to make the playoffs because there weren't any wild cards, but they didn't make the playoffs. And I tell you what, the attendance actually at Busch Stadium number two, for the first part of the 70s was fine. Because it was a situation where people all over Major League Baseball were going to fewer games at that time. And so the attendance all around Major League Baseball was down. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is if you look at the average crowd sizes in the 1970s, they look like, oh my gosh, that was terrible. But for that particular time, it wasn't terrible. In fact, the Cardinals for half the decade were above average in attendance, and then it kind of petered out over the last 3 or 4 years of the 70s. But even then, it wasn't embarrassing. They were like 13th, 14th in attendance. Okay, now let's fast forward. So the Whitey Herzog era, after he, filled the place up again during the 80s, that came to a close. And so starting from 1990 through 1995, the Cardinals were way down in attendance. I mean, it was pretty good. In fact, the first couple years of the 90s were really good, but then that started to go down and down and down and down. So what happened? That successful era, just like the one in the 60s, was led into a attendance downturn each time when that era drew to a close. So then it took Bill DeWitt and his partners to buy the team in 96, and they started making moves. Tony La Russa, Mark McGwire, Jim Edmonds, right on down the line. They started making moves. And, the baseball team became great again. And then Busch Stadium was packed again. Well, that era came to a close. And now people are taking a break again. So I think especially for people like, outside of St. Louis, but even people in St. Louis, I think there's been like a complete total absence of perspective about putting this attendance issue into context. I think it needs to be discussed, but people are acting like the sky has already fallen, like this has never happened before. I'm always startled when a great fan base, in effect, doesn't really know its own history.
The history, yeah.
Yeah.
So my thing is not to try to be a jerk. I'm defending the fans. Because this is something we see all across baseball.
Let me ask you guys.
I mean, when the Philadelphia Phillies and Atlanta Braves were going through this not all that long ago, their crowds were down.
Yep.
I mean, it's just everyone's acting like this is just all the worst thing that's ever happened. And it's actually fairly common.
So I consider the Cardinals to be a middle-of-the-road spending team who have always had the Cardinal way, which drove other teams crazy, Cardinals Nation, the devil magic, the whole thing. Going back to 96 when the DeWitts bought the team, have they always been consistent with that, or did they come out of the gate spending some money?
Well, they came out of the gate spending some money the first year because Tony La Russa, Walt Jocketty recruited him, and Tony La Russa became the Cardinals manager, and he had other options. And Tony La Russa asked for some things. He said, look, I need to reshape this roster. Walt and I want to do that, and I'm going to need certain things, and I think we're going to have to expand the payroll because that's the only way to get it done. So they went out and made all kinds of moves before 96. I mean, Ron Gant, Gary Gaetti, Andy Bennis, Todd Stottlemyre, Dennis Eckersley, Rick Honeycutt, Gary Gaetti. I think I mentioned him. If I didn't, I apologize. In other words, they went out and got about 7-8 impact players, and the payroll went up by quite a bit. and they won the division in his first year in 96. But then there was a downturn after that because they did, you know, the Cardinals ran into that problem where they weren't developing their own pitching. And then when some of the guys that they brought in got hurt, they had a lack of pitching depth. And then things sort of went bad again. And then they had to sort of get back to what they were doing. And that's, you know, around 2001, 2002, Bill DeWitt hired Jeff Luhnow because he said, look, it was great that we were able to bring in all these players at one time and we kind of jump-started the franchise. But these players we brought before 96 have gotten old. And we've been fortunate to make some great trades, but it's not going to be easy to keep making those kind of trades because teams are not going to be giving away their players the way they once did. So we need to redevelop our farm system. And he brought Jeff Luhnow in to do it. And Luhnow did a great job at it. So what Bill DeWitt's doing now, once again, another example of people who don't even know their own history. Jeff Luhnow came in and did something that Bill DeWitt wants Heim Bloom to do. To totally restore, renovate, rehab, whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
a broken player development system, especially when it comes to starting pitching. And that's what Heim Bloom's going to do. People look at this, the ignorant among us look at this and they're like, oh, this is just because Bill DeWitt doesn't want to spend money. No, actually, it's not. It's about Bill DeWitt wanting to get back to what the Cardinals, when they have been good, have always done, which is to have a great farm system that's cranking out players that's going to give you the foundation for a roster, which you then supplement by going outside the organization, make some trades, a couple signings. Bill DeWitt he's had a couple of top 10 payrolls during his time as the owner, mm-hmm. but most of the time they've been in that number 11, 12, 13, yep. 14 area.
Yep.
So I like the way people revise history, it's just hysterical to me, you know, the only reason people are screaming and shouting about this is because everyone was so accustomed to winning at such a high level mm-hmm. for so long. I don't know whether they somehow thought this would continue into perpetuity or it never does. It never does.
One more thing here.
Sure.
And again, I don't mean to be self-deprecating to the point of nausea. I just know my place when this group of people talk, but one of the games I was at this past week, they were giving Brendan Donovan basically the Hustle Award. And John Mozeliak came out and he was with Ali and Dal Raboski. And I have met Mozeliak. I don't know him like you guys know him, but I could feel coming from him the dread of walking out there and getting booed.
Yeah.
And I look at it and I say, I've given this company and this city 25 pretty good years. At some point, and maybe I already have, I'll lose my fastball and it will end badly. I mean, if I stay long enough, it'll end badly. I, for one, appreciate Mo. I appreciate what he did. I appreciate the great teams we've had during his tenure. And I'm willing to stand up and applaud him and say, yeah, it didn't end great, but thank you.
Well, see, I'm glad you said that because this is another part about this whole downturn with the Cardinals that I hate. Look, John Mozeliak did lose his fastball, but John Mozeliak also works for Bill DeWitt, who has the final say in everything. Mm-hmm. And Bill DeWitt, I've been saying this, unfortunately, saying this, you know, without people paying attention to it, been saying this for 10 years. Bill DeWitt, it isn't John Mozeliak as an independent operator. Bill DeWitt is in on every single decision they make. He is as much a part of the baseball decisions as John Mozeliak. They were a great team for a long time, but they let things fall apart at the player development level, the minor league level, the facilities, the instruction, the technology. There was a complacency that said an assumption that it would always happen because they had such a great model. And by the time they recognized it, it was kind of too late and what they had built had kind of eroded. But there have been times where I have defended John Mozeliak, and I'm going to write a nice tribute to him before he officially turns it over because people forget the amazing impact he made for a long time. But this is how nasty it is with people out there. I will have people to actually push back on me saying, well, listen, man, what he did for the Cardinals to help them win that 2011 World Series, I actually have people, and they're serious. They say, he didn't do anything. He didn't do anything. First of all, he made a steal of a trade for Matt Holliday. He traded a guy named Jim Edmonds who wanted to be traded, demanded to be traded. He got him for a third baseman named David Freeze. We may have heard of him. He went out and got Lance Berkman for a cheap contract, and everybody at the time was just savaging the move. And Lance Berkman was great in 2011. He went out and traded Colby Rasmus in a move that saved their pitching staff because they got a starting pitcher and three relievers out of it. And if they don't do that, they don't even make the playoffs. Mm-hmm. But there are people that will, you know, will actually say with a straight face, oh, he never did anything. What are you talking about, Miklas? What did he do? That was La Russa's team. It was La Russa's team that he managed. John Mozeliak was the one who actually went out and got the talent.
Glad to hear that.
It's a sad thing, but it just basically just mirrors the rest of the world at this point.
Yeah, you're right.
You're not allowed to have perspective. You're not allowed to acknowledge that while something is coming to an end, what preceded it was pretty awesome. You know, how many fan bases out there, Bernie? You know, you grew up in Baltimore. I grew up in Detroit. I've got friends that live in Chicago that are White Sox fans or Cubs and Cubs fans. I've got friends that live in all parts of the country. Pittsburgh, buddy of mine lives in Pittsburgh. How many fan bases can say that they've had a 20-year run, 25-year run like the Cardinals had?
Not many, my friend.
Maybe three or four.
Right.
Maybe Yankee fans have. Dodger fans haven't.
No. Nope.
Their run hasn't been 20 or 25 years. It's been about 10, maybe 11. And before that, they sucked. So, like, it's not common. That's the exception, not the rule.
Well, that, you know, and I grew up in Baltimore, as you said, and, you know, Earl Weaver and that whole group. I mean, it was an unbelievable run of baseball, great baseball. I mean, three pennants in a row, among other things, all kinds of Hall of Famers. Earl Weaver, Hall of Fame manager. When Earl retired, that thing went to hell in a hurry. And, you know, the Orioles went through a very, very, very long time where they did nothing. And, you know, as a kid growing up in Baltimore, I thought, well, it'll be like this forever. And it wasn't. And they really hit some hard times. They came back a couple times. Then they fell apart again.
Yep.
And I don't understand this mindset that we're, and whatever fan base we're talking about anywhere, if there's sustained success that number one, they think it's going to last forever. And number two, they start hating people when the inevitable thing happens, which is a downturn because no great era lasts into some kind of eternal form, you know, and you go back, by the way, and I feel like I got to throw this in because you guys got me started. You know, people, another thing Mozeliak doesn't get credit for, and I've had people fight me on this, so to speak. I'll say, well, you know, he did draft Albert Pujols and Yadier Molina. No, he didn't. Yeah, Jocketty did. No, I'm sorry. Mozeliak was in charge of the draft when they selected Pujols and Yadier Molina. But nobody, people don't want to give him credit for that, even though he was the one who actually stepped to the phone to call in who they were drafting. Oh, no, he didn't do that. Like, he was in the back eating shrimp or something. He had nothing to do.
We're running way over time here, and I need Bernie to do Saliga, but I will say this. I do think that a lot of it is that Mo ties sweaters around his shoulders and says things like arbitrage. I really do. Yeah. I think it didn't sit well with the Midwestern St. Louis people. So take that for what it's worth.
No, you're right. 100% right. And he got kind of snippy too. He wasn't very good at messaging. And I've told him this, you know, I even said, look, what are you doing, man? You're kind of smug when you talk to people, like you're talking down to them. You better stop doing that. It's not helping your cause. But that's so much for my advice, right?
Let's hear about Saliga, Burn. Only a couple minutes here. I have a weird little topic. I have YouTube television, and it is offering me / pushing me on split screen where it knows I like CNN, it knows I like Fox 2, and they'll be like, how about both of them at the same time?
Yeah.
And I hate it, and I don't know who likes it. Oh,
I
now,
love it.
Yeah, now I do. Yeah, I remember now. You're the one.
Games. But for games, though, not for other stuff. Like, there's nothing cooler. I on the MLB app, I'll have four games up at once, five games up at once.
See, I don't think I'd even do that for sports.
Oh.
It's yeah, the way my brain works, it would just be confusing.
So, like, what it is like you'll have a game, like, say, like, my main game is the Cardinals, and then I'll have three others that are in smaller screens on the right. And then when that game goes to commercial, I just click one, boom, now that one's on the big screen.
Would you do that, Rach, with, like, the U.S. Open to watch a bunch of...
Yeah, I have YouTube TV as well, and sometimes they'll offer that, you know, if there's, like, two... If it's on ESPN and ESPN2. Yeah. I don't typically want to watch two at once, but I could see how it would be... pretty useful.
But for what you said, Dave, no chance.
Yeah.
That'd be too distracting.
For just like shows.
Yeah. Too distracting.
I'm going to watch Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad.
I'm going to watch the scroll on one TV and another scroll on another TV.
Yeah.
Because there's always crap on the screen on the news places.
But like an old man, I get inappropriately angry about it. All they're doing is offering me an option.
Right. Here's a thing you could do if you wanted to.
Dag nabbit, take that.